Okay, I'm going to call the long-term care division to order. So thank you, members. We're going to hold off on the minutes until we have a quorum. Today, we have a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Human Services on nursing facility payment rate overview. So we're going to learn all about historically how we've paid nursing homes in the state of Minnesota, what has happened the last few years on value-based reimbursement formula changes. And so I'm going to have the agency introduce themselves and then start the presentation. And that sounds like the slide deck, you're having problems loading it up, but you should have the slide deck in front of you. So just kind of remind us on what page you're on so we can help follow it. And then, committee members, next week we're going to start hearing some bills. So we'll look for the agenda this week. So if you want to testify, introduce yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan Pollack. I'm Assistant Commissioner for DHS. With me today is Val Cook, the Division Director for our Nursing Facility Payment Division. What we're planning to do is to go through about 30 or 40 slides. This is intended to be informal and just level set for the committee on the policy and background of how we pay for nursing facility services, the trends and historical approaches that the legislature and the state have taken, and then we'll finish up with some of the governor's budget that relates to this policy area. But please interrupt and ask as many questions as you want, because I think that will be beneficial to us to understand kind of where you're coming from as well. I should warn you that I was always under the impression that work with the legislature involved no math, and this actually involves quite a lot of math, so that is one risk I'll just start with. If you start to the first slide, we just wanted to level set that, you know, DHS and MDH are both involved in the nursing home space. One department, the Department of Health, is the regulator of nursing facilities. They do that on behalf of the federal government or CMS. The Department of Human Services is the purchaser of Medicaid services at nursing facilities. And obviously payment rates are determined and quality of care determined by us in conjunction with the health department. We work closely with them. If you go to the next slide, services for nursing facilities are bundled. It's a comprehensive package of room, board, but it doesn't include medication, hospitalization, PT, OT, speech therapy, all excluded. Nursing home level of care, thank you.
You toggle through your.
I'm sorry.
Nursing home care requires an assessment to make sure that the person needs the nursing facility level of care prior to admission. And today, what we see is, and you'll see this later on in the slides, is decreasing utilization of nursing facility services overall. Number of beds being utilized is dropping, and most admissions are resulting in hospitalization. And then the last point on this, I think, is particularly important. Of the 61,000 admissions to a nursing facility, well more than half were there for just 30 days or less. Under the funding sources slide, thank you. Appreciate it.
Not a problem.
So we're on 4 or 5. Medicaid is not the only payer of nursing facility services, obviously. We have private pay contributing substantially, and Medicare paying for those short-term stays. One particular feature of Minnesota's purchasing of nursing homes is something called the rate equalization law. And so for the private pay personal income share of this, those residents are paying the exact same rate as a Medicaid recipient is paying. And that is somewhat unique. Is there any other state in the country that has rate equalization? North Dakota is the only other one.
Assistant Commissioner Paula, could you explain the portion that Medicare pays and what that 10% is for the members here?
Yeah, some portion of Medicare will cover some post-hospital rehab
typically for 20 up to 20 or 30 days. And so as long as there's therapy being provided and there's improvement, then they are eligible for a Medicare benefit.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Cook.
So I'm going to go forward another two slides into the trends on payment rates. This is kind of reflective of where costs are today. So we're at $260 a day, $8,000 a month, $96,000 a year. Nursing facilities really, short of a hospitalization, it's one of the most expensive settings. And as a state, as a purchaser, we want to encourage people to have as many options to stay in their community and live in the setting that's most appropriate for them. Usually that's not a nursing home. That's often a lesser level of care. And these costs are going up because of state policy, and we'll get into kind of more of the background of this. So on the forecast, nursing facility payment is a portion of the long-term care forecast for Medicaid. And this will be updated for the February forecast, but these are numbers from November. The growth is about 76% on a 10-year horizon from 2014 to 2023. The state's costs have gone from $759 million to $1.3 billion. And that is pretty substantial, particularly given that the number of residents actually utilizing the service are dropping, estimated to drop about 12%. Part of the rising cost is because wages are going up, and wages are going up by design. As you'll hear later on, we have developed a system that intentionally pays the wages that are market rate, because this is a high-cost area of care delivery, and we don't want to see shortages. We want facilities to be able to hire. But the wages are going up, and you can see these among the care staff pretty substantially since 2013, which predates the payment reform. So I'm not going to go through all of these. You can look at them later.
I have a question here. I'm going to interrupt you. Representative Gruenhagen, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. Say, what you made a statement, maybe you'll explain it later in the presentation, that a lot of the costs are going up due to state mandates or regulations or whatever. And we actually see a decrease in the number of patients, but yet an increase in the cost. Are you going to address that in later slides?
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, yeah, what I was alluding to is the value-based reimbursement was designed to increase spending and increase cost based on the cost of care reported by the facilities. But I will get into more detail on that later on.
Okay.
Okay, now I'm going to let Val take over and talk a little bit about the historical approaches we've taken to payment.
Yeah, Ms. Cook, can you introduce yourself again, please, for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Valerie Cook, the Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy at DHS. So to understand kind of where we are today, we thought it would be helpful to do a little bit of a historical walkthrough from where we came from. And so on the slide here, we start talking about in 1995, the alternative payment system, which moved us into a contracting system. But I think it's important to point out that prior to that, for several years, we had been what traditionally known as Rule 50, which was a cost-based system, very similar to where we are in today's environment. That's why I kind of wanted to make that point. And so when we moved away from the cost-based system in with Rule 50, there were some limitations to that made things difficult. There was geographic groupings that varied across the state. Moving into alternative payment system was designed to provide more flexibility for providers. It was much less detailed reporting. But it relied so that as we moved into this alternative payment approach, it was a voluntary, so facilities could move into APS or they could remain with the cost-based system for a few years. Eventually, it became mandatory for all facilities to move into this APS system. And that was initially designed then to provide that flexibility but to rely on an annual inflation adjustment. for rising costs. And so the relationship between actual costs and rates started to get lost over those years. And even though originally inflation factor was included in the APS, legislature often suspended it, so it was not a guaranteed annual income, and then we kind of evolved into requiring a legislative appropriation every biennium or even on an annual basis to try to address increases in nursing home costs. So then that led to, in about 2007, there was a legislation was passed to go to rebasing, to return back to setting rates based on facility costs. And so, but that attempt then, you know, was supposed to be phased in over 8 years, and I think the first year or two was a very small proportion of it was based on actual costs. And so, but after a couple of years of that, again, the rebasing was suspended for a number of years, and so that again brought us back to more like the cost of living adjustment appropriations required by the legislature on a more frequent basis. So that brings us back to where we are today, which is value-based reimbursement. So this was established by the legislature in 2015. It was a very significant investment in nursing homes, over $400 for the two biennials, $400 million. We brought us back again to rates are paid based on actual costs reported by facilities. And the one feature about VBR that was not part of what we talked about earlier is the old cost-based system under Rule 50 is that there is a quality feature included in this VBR framework, which I'll be addressing a little bit more later.
Ms. Cook, how do you verify their costs in the system?
Madam Chair, so cost reports are filed with the department on an annual basis. We do have auditors that review all of those costs. We request additional documentation. And because of the way the various rate components are set, there's more audit emphasis on certain portions of the cost report than others, but I can talk a little bit more about that when we get into the rate components.
Thank you.
I'm having trouble running this, but anyway, so value-based reimbursement or VBR. So just to step back and what were the primary goals with that investment that was made in nursing facilities? And part of it was obviously to try to address the workforce issues that are so within nursing homes. So we're trying to look at low wages, poor benefit packages, retention, and recruitment. The other component, one of the goals, was to increase the Medicaid reimbursement that was is targeted directly to direct care and care-related services. And the third piece is that, as I mentioned, is this quality incentive. It's designed so that the state will reimburse higher costs if you have higher quality. And so it's an attempt to try to align with the rates with the level of quality. So within the rate, this is a daily per diem rate that we're referring to here. There's five components. And so one is that what we call the direct care. And that's the costs that are primarily associated with nursing costs and patient care. We have another care component which looks at like activities, social services, religious personnel, et cetera. And then we have an other operating component, and that's some of the other functions that are required in a nursing home to keep it going, and housekeeping, dietary staff, plant operations and maintenance. There's like a component called external fixed costs. And so those are costs that are we consider a pass-through cost, such as surcharge fees, license fees. This category is a place where we capture time-limited rate adjustments, for example, under another quality improvement program and some of those things. And then the last component is the property component, which we'll be talking about more as we go through this presentation. So to get into the rate calculation a little more specifically, so direct care costs, as a reminder of those nursing costs, are they're divided by standardized days, and that's it's an important distinction from resident days. And so those nursing costs, when we're determining an average nursing cost per day, if you are higher acuity or have higher needs, that average comes down. If you're lower needs, the average comes up, just for comparison purposes. And I'll explain a little bit further on how the acuity is used in establishing that actual residence pay per diem. Then we have the other direct care costs that we just divide by the facility resident days for that 12-month period. And then the other operating component is a little different. This is not necessarily entirely cost-based. What we do is that we review the operating costs in the 7-county metro area, determine what that median is for just the 7-county metro area, and then we multiply that by 105%. And so that 105% of the median, or the metro median, is the price that's paid for other operating for all nursing homes in the state. So every nursing home gets the same price for that cost category. The external fixed is just, it's a collection of some pass-through costs, and so that is just a matter of summing those together to determine a daily rate. And then the property rate, the property system has been around for a number of years. This has not been rebased at this point. And so this is a historical rate. Probably has had some inflation over the years, some adjustments to it for construction projects, or large, replacement projects. And so it is primarily based on a historical property rate from 15 plus or more years ago. So just to do a little bit more of a deeper dive to demonstrate how these rates work, this is an example of the operating rate component. And so the operating rate, when you hear us speak about the operating rate, it's really a sum of the care-related per diem, the other operating costs, and then that total operating rate. And so those are just put together. And I think the point that I wanted to make here, when we talk about the operating rate, 50% or more of that is typically in that actual direct care related part of it. So the direct care is by far, the most expensive service part of it, of the nursing facility's operations. So resident rates are actually case mix adjusted. So Minnesota is a little bit unique in that we have specific rates for each facility, and we have specific rates all the way down to the resident level. And that residence rates, as Dan mentioned earlier, rate equalization, this becomes pretty important because the Medicaid rate is also setting what the private pay people are paying. So their rates will vary depending on the level of care that they are required. We do the facility does a very long and involved assessment when the resident is admitted to their nursing home. These assessments are submitted through the federal government and back to the Department of Health. And that resident then is assigned into a resource group, or what we call a RUG group. And so our system that we use to establish these resident rates is a RUG system where the acuity levels can go from as low as to, less than a point to as high as 3.0. So this demonstrates that rates could vary. If you're going into a nursing home as a resident, if you were to go to this sample nursing home, your rate could be as low as $140 a day or as high as $403. So this is how the total payment rate, so we've talked about how the operating rate is built up, and then there's a property rate, and we mentioned the external fixed rate, and those three pieces add up then to the total daily rate. And I think the point I wanted to make with this slide is, again, if you notice the amount of the operating rate here in this example, the 197 out of a total rate of 245. So, again, that operating portion of the rate is what really drives the total payment rate in large proportion of it. So as we talk about budget growth and cost growth, it's, you know, it's primarily being driven by this operating component. So to get back again and talk a little bit more about the quality incentive that was designed as part of value-based reimbursement. So direct care costs are limited for each facility based on their facility's quality score. And so the way that limit calculation starts, again, we go back to the seven county metro median, and we start there and draw a line. And then for each facility, their specific direct care-related limit will move up and down, up above or below that line, depending on their quality score. So under the current formula, though, the way, you know, we feel that that initial quality limit was set too low, too high. So to show, for an example, under this current framework, a facility would only need a quality score of 19 out of 100 before they would be affected, they would at least get the metro median at that point. Most of the facility scores are between 60 and 80. We don't have any facilities that have a score even, you know, remotely close to that number. So that's part of the challenge that we're trying to address.
Representative Grunhagen, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just do our neighboring states use this same type of system? One of the things that helps lay people, I decided, is, you know, historical and comparative. It'd be nice to see what other states around us are doing, what their average costs are, and do they have a similar system, or are we doing something completely different than them that may or may not be affecting our cost or quality of care? I just came from an education policy meeting, and one of the things it was a committee meeting on special ed, and the amount of paperwork that people are spending, teachers and others that work with special ed students, they're spending more time filling out paperwork than they are with the student. My concern about this is it seems like there's an awful lot of reporting that has to go into this system, value-based reimbursement, and it has a lot of variables in it. From my perspective, again, a lay person just looking at it initially, I can't help but believe there's got to be a simpler way to do this, or maybe I'm off base. Why don't you respond to that? I'm open to correction.
Madam Chair, Representative, a cost-based system is probably not uncommon in other states, and I certainly could gather some data and provide information back to you summarizing what those rate-setting systems are in our neighboring states. I think that what you're pointing out is probably what happened with Rule 50, and we transitioned into this, you know, this annual inflation adjustment and moved away from costs, which then becomes difficult, and now we're transitioning back to cost base. I don't believe it's unusual. I would say most states require an annual cost report. But as I mentioned, we can certainly gather a little more information about our neighboring state system and get back to you on that.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So to continue just talking about the quality framework in VBR, right now it's based on a relatively simple approach. We rely on three quality measures. The quality measures that we use are also on the Minnesota Nursing Home Report Card, if you're familiar with that. Out of this 100-point scale, 50% of it is based on a set of clinical quality indicators. We call it the Minnesota Risk-Adjusted Quality Indicator, but they're primarily assessing clinical quality. And then the next component there is the resident quality of life score, and we do annual face-to-face interviews on a sample basis in all the nursing facilities, interviewing residents about their quality of life. So that's 40% of the total composite score. And then the last measure currently used is the state inspection results, which is 10% of the overall score.
So, Ms. Cook, can you just clarify the quality scores that we are using? Are those like Minnesota-grown, Minnesota-based quality scores? Are other states using something similar?
Madam Chair, they are Minnesota-specific quality measures, but the clinical quality measures, if you set them side by side with the federal quality indicators, they're pretty much the same. We do a little more risk adjustment so that they're more fairly comparing facilities. The resident quality of life, we feel very fortunate that we have the resources to do that. That's pretty unique to get the resident's perspective. As far as I know, that the process of actually going out and doing interviews with residents occurs in state of Ohio. There may be one or two other smaller states that do it, but so that's rather unique. The state inspections, of course, all nursing facilities across the country are surveyed and, you know, under federal compliance regulation. The way that we score and measure that is unique to Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
So as part of the value-based reimbursement investment, there was an appropriation made to evaluate the program. And so, and we also report every other year to the legislature on the impact that the VBR is having. We just recently published the report in January of our most recent study. We've contracted with an external evaluation team from Purdue and University and University of Minnesota. And they have done an in-depth analysis on the using cost report data that we have and also comparing that to some the quality data that we have. Some of their very high-level conclusions, as you would expect, as Medicaid revenue per facility rose quite sharply when we moved into VBR. There was that initial rebase year where costs were significantly higher than what nursing facilities were being paid at that time, so that was a significant initial rebase. There weren't any real established patterns or trends across organization types or anything like that that was discovered. But the evaluators do say that they saw no evidence that VBR's quality incentive as it's designed led to higher facility quality. So the evaluators made a couple of recommendations, and both of those recommendations ultimately lead to the governor's proposal that you see before this year regarding nursing facilities. So their recommendation was to include an inflation index limit on that other operating price. That does affect all nursing facilities, but it is in the non-care-related cost category. And so we're proposing an inflation cap on that component of the rate. And the second one is to make some recommendations on how to redesign that quality framework. It's actually we retained the original idea of we'll pay more for higher quality. But what this does is moves those limits so that they're more impactful for facilities to be paying attention to.
Ms. Cook, can you describe what the limit for inflation would be set at in the governor's proposal?
Madam Chair, so we tie that to what we call the skilled nursing facility market basket, and right now it's about 3.05%. That would be an annual figure.
Can you explain that index that you just mentioned?
So how that would work is that, you know, we have established now the operating price based on that 105% of the median. So for the January 1st, 2019 rate. So when it comes time for us to establish the 2020 rate, we would compare actual costs that are reported to that metro median, and we'd figure out what the price would be, and then we would compare that. If that exceeds more than 3% inflation, then we would cap it at just 3%.
Okay, thank you.
So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Dan to talk about the governor's proposal.
I'm going to jump back just really quickly to an earlier slide. I agree, Madam Chair, with Representative Gruenhagen's comments that this is complex. And so as I'm going through the governor's proposal, this particular slide is useful to just kind of fold over for yourselves. So there's five major components of the rates. And the governor's proposal opens up the gearbox on three of them. It's direct care, which I'll talk about, the other operating, and property. And then two of them, other care and external fixed costs, really don't get affected at all. Okay. If you carried your big budget binder with you today, this is on page 126. It's the change page called Nursing Facility Value-Based Reimbursement and Property Payment Reform. And what the governor and the commissioner are proposing is really to address some of the trend line concerns with the cost of this particular payment mechanism. So first and foremost, it creates a new quality limit to create incentives for poor performing facilities to really improve their quality, and I'll go into that in just a minute. Secondarily, there's a cap on the annual rate of growth for other operating that Val mentioned. There's a change to the hold harmless clause, and then a continued suspension of something called the critical access nursing facility provision, which is essentially obsolete. There's a second component of it that requires nursing facilities to do an additional assessment following the end of therapy treatments, and that has to do with what we were talking about before, you know, whether a resident is being assessed at the right level of need, and if somebody is a private pay and they aren't assessed for this therapy in a timely way, they might be overcharged. So that saves the state funding, saves the state's budget money as well. And then lastly, there's a component that reforms the property payment rate system, and that's actually a spending proposal that's built into this package. Okay. So first is the quality incentive. And this, remember, really does relate back to how the direct care portion is determined. The overall rate impacts this. As Val mentioned, when this was first conceived, the quality limit, the upper payment limit, was really set pretty high. There's different ways to think about it. It's, if you think of the game of limbo, the limbo stick can be held really high up and everybody gets under the stick. Another way is sort of like the Lake Wobegon, you know, idea. All nursing homes are above average, and we're paying them all really well. 97% of facilities right now are below the limit, which means they have no effective incentive for quality improvement. There are about 8 who are over the limit, and we've had some questions about those. We think that those are all hospital attached, and that's the basis for them being above the limit currently. So what the governor's budget does is it lowers the line. It lowers the quality limit, and it creates more stratification among all payment rates to create incentives for quality improvement. So under this proposal, you'd go down to about 76% roughly after implementation would be below the quality limit. So roughly a quarter of facilities would have at least some incentive for quality improvement.
Are you trying to say that it would have been really difficult for these nursing homes to achieve that first quality limit, so they didn't even attempt to improve quality because the limit was set too high?
Madam Chair, so their costs, because the limit was set so high, their costs are far, like $40-$50 below that limit, just the way it was designed. And that limit just would keep moving up every year because the metro median continues to move up every year. So the lack of incentive was just that it would take a tremendous amount of spend up before they would actually hit it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the next piece is the other operating rate, and we kind of covered this a little, but as Val mentioned, other operating is really non-care services. So it's dietary, housekeeping, laundry, utilities, general operations, administration. And that component of the rate is growing rapidly and is contributing to the overall cost trend. So as previously mentioned, this piece of the governor's budget would cap the annual growth rate to a known index, and that index currently is 3% growth. So this would continue growth in those costs and continue paying more for that portion of nursing facility services each year, but it would limit the increase each year to about 3% to slow the overall growth rate. And this is just a table showing the year-to-year change. So you see VBR takes effect January 1, 2016, and that growth rate was 6% and then 8%. And then this reflects the governor's budget proposal at 3% for a cap. Next is the component of the budget proposal on property payment. And as Val mentioned, the historic property reimbursement system today is really an artifact, a legacy of the old style payment. It doesn't really provide a fair basis. There's various exceptions built into law currently today to account for that. But this really modernizes and reforms the property reimbursement system based on a fair rental value system to allow facilities to make improvements, to reduce inequities, and we want them to have incentives to really replace buildings and do other structural capital improvements, and the payment rate would adjust for that. This does include a small portion of investment to also fund future moratorium exception projects. And this particular reform is actually phased in over a number of years to give them time to adjust to the system, knowing that, you know, there might be capital projects underway or in the works already. And then this just restates the last two, which are really smaller changes, but the therapy incentive being changed to really determine if somebody needs additional therapy for that entire 90-day period, and then critical access nursing facility suspension. And that was basically an older model of payment that predated the VBR system and was suspended when VBR took effect. So this is an overall table that shows you the relative fiscal impacts of these different components of this change item. And obviously there are significant changes in spending for some of them more so than others. But you can see here, you know, where the new spending is on property reform and where the state's budget is really impacted. And now I think we're happy to take questions.
Any questions, Representative Munson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am kind of getting up to speed on all the regulations in this nursing home, and I'm really interested in the metrics that we judge quality on, and I see that there appears to be a shift from having a value incentive to moving towards a quality incentive, if I've read that right. In my mind, value takes, you know, quality with respect to spending versus, you know, just having a quality incentive alone would basically take the value out of it and just look at spending more. If I heard you correctly at the beginning, where you were talking about the number of people that were serving in nursing homes, is that it was declining? Is that right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the property or the reimbursement rate for the fixed rate for their facilities, do they take their fixed rates of operating the facility and then divide it by the number of current occupants to get a rate, or is it, so in other words, empty beds? The cost of empty beds would be burdened on the other residents as part of their factor, or is that fixed per person that they serve in the facility? Can you speak to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, so the rates are based on the cost report, and so the 12-month period of cost of the data that we're collecting, we also collect resident days for that same 12-month period. And so we're calculating a daily rate per day based on costs and resident days, and then there's a lag before the rates are effective. But so what happens is that if their occupancy is declining during the rate year, then the revenue is declining because it's a per daily charge. But as we establish the rate, there's a relationship on the total resident days and total costs. So variable costs would likely come down as resident days come down, but you're absolutely correct. I mean, there will be some fixed rate costs that are more difficult to respond to as occupancy is declining.
Okay. And follow up, Madam
Chair.
Representative
Monson.
As with the hospitals that have the number of beds that they apply for in certain areas where we have moratoriums on, it was surprising to me to learn that the legislature actually authorizes beds for hospitals to be built. Do we have the same type of regulations on nursing facilities where, or it could more and more nursing facilities be built in a certain area, in other words, overbuilding, and then take these fixed costs of operating and apply it to the number of residents that basically increase the cost that they receive per resident? Is that, do we have any regulations on how many nursing facilities can be built?
Ms. Madam Chair, Representative, we do have a moratorium on nursing home beds in Minnesota since about the 1980s, when there was a substantial upsizing of the nursing home industry going on at that point. The moratorium does not allow for additional new beds being added to the Medicaid system. There is some features in current law where we can relocate beds from one community to another, for instance, if a major project is done, but there's a limit to adding beds unless there is a hardship in a certain community. So say a rural community could demonstrate a hardship for access, which is something we've not used to date, but that provision is available.
And I just have one more question. When we did implement these quality incentives for providers, and I assume that there were a limited number of quality incentives you were looking at for scoring, did you see a shift in behavior from providers to kind of increase those specific quality indicators that you were looking for in order to score them higher, or is it to the detriment of other things that should have been focused on?
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative. So VBR is just one of three quality incentives we have in our payment system. We have a couple other programs that reward quality improvement, and those are where facilities are targeting a specific quality area, and then they can earn a reward or a bonus with that. Depending on which program you're talking about, we definitely see a relationship between a focused effort in a certain quality area and improvement in those scores. Those two programs are kind of designed to provide resources and reward quality improvement from some baseline to a better spot. The quality framework that we're trying to incent here is in VBR is that to reward high quality, high performing facilities. So that's it's a different approach, but we feel it's quite comprehensive because we also want lower performing facilities to be able to get resources to help themselves improve their quality.
And Representative Gruenhagen?
Oh, Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, sure. To Representative Munson's original just preliminary question. There is a change in the quality framework in the governor's budget on this slide, and so rather than just the scoring methods that we have today, this would add a short stay component, which I think is important given how many residents are using short stay. It also has a family satisfaction survey, which I think is important to know what families are really experiencing.
Thank you. Representative Gruenhagen?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. When you do these qualities ratings, I got two quick questions. When you do these qualities ratings, does the number of complaints or verified complaints of elder abuse factor into the quality of care that a facility is actually rated?
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. And that component called the state inspection surveys, so those that takes into consideration 2 or 3 years worth of survey history, OHFC complaints, findings, scope and severity of the deficiencies, and those are all built into the methodology for developing a final rating for state health inspection, and they're updated on a quarterly basis.
Representative Gruenhagen?
Oh, Madam Chair, this is just a general comment. Are you planning to have people from the nursing homes? Are they going to testify on the governor's proposal, or is that at a different meeting?
We will look at the governor's pieces of the governor's budget that are specific to long-term care, and we can have, we'll take testifiers on it as well. And then we'll also have separate pieces of legislation to address the recommendations from this report to help improve quality reporting and evaluate our the reimbursement system. So we're open to hearing bills from both sides on payment reform to nursing homes and how we can achieve a goal of high quality and affordability and efficiency in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. So we're still waiting for the governor's specific language to come out on this issue. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone from the audience who would wish to testify about nursing homes since we have time? No? On VBR, value-based reimbursement systems, any of the adjustments? Or maybe that they're not ready yet.
What?
Go ahead, Representative Grunhagen.
I got about 50 questions, so I'm trying to limit myself. Okay. thank you, Madam Chair. To what degree, I don't know how, if you can respond to this or not, Commissioner or Ms. Cook, are federal and state mandates and regulations contributing to the cost, increasing cost of nursing homes? It just seems like it just keeps going up with no end in sight. I'm the first person who wants to support higher wages for the people who actually do the care, okay? They're doing God's work, right, taking care of those people. And I've had a father-in-law in the nursing home. I've had customers and friends in the nursing home. And they need, once they're certified, they need that care. But, is the state issuing a lot of regulations, mandates, and then the feds that are continually driving up that cost? Because when I've looked at it in the past, it doesn't seem like the people actually doing the care get that much of what's actually being paid for those rooms. If you'd like to respond to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think one of the benefits and virtues of the VBR system is that whatever it costs, whatever the wages, local wage rates are demanding for that care facility, they are able to pay that under this system. They are able to be reimbursed by the state based on their actual costs. So unlike other industries that might be in front of the HHS committee, other parts of the care delivery system writ large, this portion of the care system can get their costs reimbursed, even if there are local spikes in wage rates or macroeconomic factors or regulatory factors that you're alluding to. Other portions of the delivery system, as I understand them, do not get this kind of treatment.
Okay. I don't completely understand that, but I'll accept that as the answer.
we need to understand it, Representative Grunhagen. So we all need to understand it so we can help improve the situation. So I think Representative Cleghorn has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm apologizing. I was in another committee testifying, so I didn't hear all of the report. So if you've answered this question, please forgive me for asking again. You mentioned that there was a moratorium on the number of beds that are available. As we're looking at our aging population, is there going to be a recommendation to increase the number of beds? I would think even having a competition in the marketplace with more beds available and it would drive down a few of the costs potentially. I don't know for sure. Will anybody be addressing that issue? Do you know the number, increasing the number of beds as our population ages?
Ms. Cook.
Madam Chair, Representative. So I think there's a couple of things that we have that address that I don't recall if you were here when I talked about the hardship provision. Mm-hmm. So there is an existing law that we can, I think it's 300 beds, every 2 years can be added if there are certain community hardship criteria that's met. And so that's one way that we can address that. As far as, the growing population potential nursing home. I think that we also see that there's a real somewhat a shift to home and community-based services as a preferential treatment, or not treatment, but a preferential setting. And so that certainly is probably having an impact on what we'll see as far as nursing home needs. But to date, we have not experienced an access issue for nursing home services yet.
Representative Cleghorn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No more questions.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, one of the things that I've sold long-term care insurance in the past, I have another agent in my office that does it now, but, you know, they've increased dependencies to get into the nursing home. I think there's 6 or 7 different dependencies. You can't feed yourself, you can't dress yourself, you can't toilet yourself. I forget what they all are, but I think in the past you could have 2 dependencies and get into a nursing home. That was many years ago. But I think they've increased that to 3 or 4. Are they continuing to tighten up the requirements to actually enter a nursing home?
Ms. Cook.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's been no initiative to change the assessment or level of care needs for access to a nursing home.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, I could ask one more. No. I'll pass.
Okay, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the slide you had up there before about the average wage rates increasing for care-related staff, I like data and charts, so this just happened to catch my eye, that they all seem to have the same fixed relationship between them as we look through. I think only the LPNs looks like, based on the chart, to slightly increase less than the others. But it seems to me that as we have a more of a demand for some of these lower wage jobs, that there would be more of an increase to get people into this industry. Is there some other regulatory factor that's kind of keeping these fixed in relation to one another? Is it unions, or is it something fixed in statute and how we reimburse as a percentage of that keeps these the same?
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not quite sure I really understand your question. One thing about the differences here, when you look at the certified nurse assistants, for instance, going from 1297 to 1630, the percentage proportion on that is, you know, about 21.5%. And as you get into the higher wage categories, the proportion or percentage of increase is not as steep. I'm not sure if that's what your question was, but the value-based reimbursement certainly does. I mean, part of the goal was to invest in these direct care workers, and so that's why they pretty much get all your direct care costs covered under the current model.
Okay.
I think the representative might be asking, is there a wage encumbrance, or are we requiring certain pass-throughs to wages? Is that what you're trying to get at,
yeah,
Representative Munson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it has to do with more of you know, I feel like there should be a larger demand for bringing people in at these lower wage positions, and it seems to me that with the freer market that these wages should go up much higher than it appears to be. So I'm just trying to figure out if there's something in statute that encumbers these wages from being raised, or just seems that they're all going up in proportion to each other the same. So.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is no wage encumbrance or any direction right now in existing law that directs that, other than the benefits, as I mentioned, about direct care costs are primarily fully covered.
Right. And these are just average wages, so, you know, it might be interesting to look at the confidence intervals in wages, or the medians, or some other relationships of the min-max wages paid in our nursing homes to get a better picture of, well, what's happening with work staff and costs. Okay, any other questions from members and agencies? Representative Grunhagen.
Okay, I'll try not to be too overbearing. But anyway, does the department or know thank you, Madam Chair. Does the department know what percentage of nursing home patients actually have a long-term care policy that pays for their care or pays part of their care? My understanding is it's less than 10% of the people who are into nursing homes.
Ms. Cook, or
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have specifics about how many residents actually use long-term care insurance, but if you look at this chart here, other category where you see 12%, that other category would include residents that are using long-term care insurance, but it also includes veterans VA benefits in that category, so private insurance, and managed care, Medicaid, managed care, like MSHO, where dual eligibles, some of their days will be covered in that as well. So you might be pretty close with your 10%. I don't know.
No. Representative Gruenhagen?
That's fine.
Okay, there's a really interesting report by our nonpartisan House research staff called Nursing Facility Reimbursement and Regulation. And you can see a breakdown of the number of nursing homes over time, the number of active beds. And we went from 28,869 active beds as of 2015 to about 15,152 for, that's the monthly average MA recipients in nursing homes, 15,152 in 2015. But the average statewide occupancy rate for nursing facilities was 87.5% for the fiscal year ending in 2015. So we're not at full occupancy. So when was the last time that we hit the moratorium? We were someone asked to lift the moratorium on the bed limit.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that, you know, by history, I'm not aware of that a moratorium request has been asked to be lifted. We fund moratorium exception projects, but that exception process still does not allow for adding beds.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cleburne.
In speaking with members of my community, there were quite a few complaints about the distance that families have to travel to see family members in nursing home facilities. And my community is Plymouth, so we're close to the metro. However, I'm wondering, what is the radius for classifying as a hardship? Is there a mileage distinction? Is it time? What constitutes a hardship? Because the person in the nursing home maybe came from one facility, but all of the family members live location, and all the family members live in a different location. So how is that hardship determined?
So I think Representative Cleburne brings up a good point that in greater Minnesota, are there nursing homes that are closing? Is there a different demand for beds to be closer to the families right. In greater Minnesota? And what is the hardship requirement that they would need to meet to shift beds to different facilities? Right. Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, under current law, there is this provision to do bed relocations. Mm-hmm. And so when facilities close, they either can completely close the bed at that point, or they kind of go in limbo and they actually can be sold on the market and be relocated. So that's one possible way to address that. And it's clear that the distribution of nursing facilities is uneven throughout the state. I'm happy to get back to you on the specific hardship criteria. I thought maybe I had it with me, but I can look that up and we'll get that back to members of the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I think we have a question from a member of the audience. She would like to come down and introduce herself and ask questions of either the agency or a comment. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Sheila Van Pelt, and I stepped in late to the committee, and I do have to leave rather shortly for another meeting. But my question, and I've testified to this in another committee in the Senate, there is a provider tax that when a person signs into a contract with their nursing home, it'll point to a statute which then can say applicable taxes or issues that relate to statutes that can be applied. Essentially, there is a statute 256.9657, and under the subdivision 1, it's a nursing home surcharge. Residents are charged annually for every licensed home nursing bed in the state $2,815 or $256 monthly. What I would like to know from Assistant Commissioner Pollack or anyone at DHS is to explain about that waiver, transparency in the statements, how it's used, Also, is there a federal match, and what are the requirements on that? So if we can have a waiver, that's one of the things I'm interested in, because the everyday citizen who comes into a nursing home, their loved one, has no idea they're paying this. And when we look at quality of care and what we're getting back, I'd like to know how this is coming back to the everyday citizen who has no idea they're even paying for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Really good question. So, Assistant Commissioner Paulette, if you could come back to the table and state your name again, and then try to answer that question about the bed fee.
Sure, Madam Chair. Dan Pollack, Assistant Commissioner DHS. And yes, there is a nursing home surcharge. There's actually different kinds of Medicaid surcharges we use for a variety of different providers in the state. And it's really a financing mechanism. The facilities are assessed the surcharge on a per resident day. You know, they pay it into the state, and it can, you know, then basically be a financing mechanism for the Medicaid system. I know in years past there have been proposals to adjust those surcharges either up or down, and obviously that's just a budget question for the legislature and the governor.
So we put a fee on every bed. We collect that in revenue. We're charging ourselves when we pay back in MA. Can you explain a little bit more how that works?
So, Madam Chair, so Ms. the Cook. Surcharge is added to the daily rate. I believe it's like $8.66 per day. And so that then becomes eligible for federal match. So we get the 50% federal match on that is because it's part of our daily per diem. And, yes, the private pay, because we are a rate equalization state, does also pay it. But, you know, I think that the rate equalization for private pays is generally viewed as a consumer, very strong consumer protection compared to what you would see in other states. So, I, you know, that's the other side of that that I would want to point out, too.
So I think the testifier's other question was, how is that portrayed to residents of a nursing home on their billing statement or invoice? Is that... are we required for that to be transparent on billing statements, and is that to be billed every month, or do we have rules in, or something in legislation to address that?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware. We do aware of any kind of disclosure requirements. We do have some requirements around private pay notices, but it's not to the. I don't believe that it would require disclosing the exact amount for the bed surcharge.
Thank you. Do you have another question? Sure. Please state your name again for the record.
Hi, Sheila Van Pelt again, Madam Chair. Question then for Assistant Commissioner Pollack. If we can have a copy of the waiver, also the federal requirements on that waiver as far as do there need to be audits done to verify costs, and also is there a kickback, for lack of a better word, back to the facility once a federal match comes in, and how that all that dollar transactions go from point A through a timeline where the transaction is complete.
Thank you.
I apologize. I do need to leave
okay.
now.
Well, we'll get the answer for you. So, Assistant Commissioner Paula, could you come back to the table and just quickly say how that transfer gets to the state, and does it go back to the provider, how that works? Or Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, so the provider pays, the state bills, sends out a billing statement to the provider for their bed tax each month. They pay that fee back to DHS, and then the cost of that is built into their daily rate, so that's how they get it back. And so depending on the proportion of Medicare or Medicaid business, you know, it's not necessarily a dollar for dollar wash. There are some things that can influence that.
Okay, and the other one, what about federal audits? Are those conducted for how the federal reimbursement gets to the providers?
Well, the surcharge is included in our state plan amendment that we have to describe our system to, our payment system to, in detail to CMS. And they review those state plan amendments and have to approve them before we can implement them. And we can implement them, but if we didn't get approval, there would be some retroactive recovery. So there is a federal review of the state plan amendments which describes the surcharge.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think we have another question from Representative Cleaborn.
Well, I just want to make sure that I understood what was just said. So as I heard, it was $8.66 daily, which if you multiply that by 365, it's $3,160.90 per bed or per patient paying the surcharge. The surcharge gets paid to the state, and then the providers request it back in their, or they get it back in their daily rates, but it's paid from the patient. Is that correct?
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, so, the state bills the provider for this tax on all their active beds.
Okay, so that's, if I may please, Madam Chair. So the provider is paying the daily charge or the patient is paying the daily charge? I think that's where my confusion came in.
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's both. So it's part of the patient's daily per diem rate, but the way the funding works is that the state bills the provider on a monthly for the monthly fee. They pay that back to the state, but we put it in the per diem so that the federal match.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? And nursing homes, like healthcare is complicated.
Long-term
care also complicated.
Human nature is complicated.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Munson.
And just to clarify on the bed tax, that is per occupied bed. It's not available bed. Is that correct? When you have if your facility has 200 beds and you're licensed, you're not paying that fee on every bed that's licensed. You're only paying it on which beds are occupied. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, the fee only applies to active beds. If your facility has an option to put beds in layaway and not necessarily close them, but we only charge the fee on active beds. But if an active bed does not have a person in it, then there isn't revenue being produced by that surcharge.
Mr. Berg just pointed out something interesting, that the revenue from these fees is going to the general fund. Is that correct, Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. I don't know that question, but I see somebody nodding their head.
Yes, Madam Chair, the revenue from surcharges is paid into the general fund.
Okay.
And I would just add, any private pay patient in any setting in the state is paying a rate that is reflective of costs, surcharges, regulation. All of those things come together. And in other settings, they're able to actually cost shift even more. If there's underpayment on Medicaid, you will see that as higher rates on the private pay patient.
Mm-hmm.
In nursing homes, we've said in law that you can't do that, that they are charged the same rate.
Right.
So there's a consumer protection at the same time that there's
are we the tax. Only state that has rate equalization?
Madam Chair, North Dakota does as
North
well.
North Dakota. So. Okay, I think Representative Munson might have one more question.
I just am putting this together in my head. I mean, if we have in rural Minnesota where we have some facilities that are not at capacity because of the decline in people that are using these facilities, the facilities then have 100 active beds, and they may only have 18 residents, then they're paying this $2,800 a year or $3,000, however it works out to be, per bed. And they're only able to collect this from certain patients that are in the facility. And you're saying that they can't charge all of the bed fees in proportion to the people that are there. So the facilities actually have a really burdened cost in this every year.
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, that facilities can manage their active beds to their anticipated occupancy. For someone to have 100 active beds with only 18 residents would be highly unusual, because that is an operating strategy. As occupancy declines, put the beds in layaway, the surcharge does not apply and is not charged by the state, but that still retains that bed. So if business picks up, they can bring that bed back into active service, and then at that time the surcharge would apply again.
Okay, Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the beds, if you have, let's say, the state issues the number of beds that you can have, is that correct? Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, so the Department of Health handles the licensing functions, yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clyburn?
But when you no longer need those beds, you made a statement earlier that you could sell those beds. So you are granted the ability to have the bed by the state without charge, and then when you complete your time with that bed, you could put it onto an open marketplace and auction it off, basically? Is that what I'm to understand?
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, so if, say for instance you are closing a facility, mm-hmm. you have a couple of options, because as facilities close, that creates savings to the Medicaid budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have these what we call like cost-neutral relocations that allows for movement of beds without creating a cost to the Medicaid budget.
Mm-hmm.
But if you also have an option of just closing your bed and getting a planned closure incentive, there's some financial incentives. So if you are an organization that owns two facilities and you close one, mm-hmm. you can create and transfer some of that savings from that closure to your other existing facility. So there's a number of complex options to deal with in those kinds of situations.
Okay. But I just wanted to make sure that we're not issuing beds for free and then someone else gets to sell them back. That's what I was confused by.
Sounds like they get some sort of financial incentive to close if they need, if they're not filling their beds. You know, we know how much, what average that incentive payment is, Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, so I think it's $2,080 per year for a closed bed. But just to clarify, the Department of Health licensed beds, but we don't, as a state, don't sell beds to providers.
I realized you don't sell them. I never heard that.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions, members? We did have a quorum, but we need to make a change to the minutes. So we'll bring the minutes back for our next meeting next week. Okay. And I think we're finished with our official business. I want to thank the agency, the testifiers, and the members. So we will adjourn. Thank you.